The subject of our panel takes us straight to the ancient Greeks. It was, of course, the ancient Greeks who gave the Western world at least, and perhaps not just the Western world, its distinction between story and history. And of course, one of the things that our panel must be concerned with today is why story is whether the Anglophone distinction between story and history maps onto distinctions to be made in other languages. The ancient Greeks also showed an endless fascination with just how permeable the boundary between story and history was. Histories are stories we live by, or is that myths? And I hope again that our panel will pursue that question. Nowhere is the boundary more permeable between story and history than in stories or histories of beginnings, a genre in which Greek literature and culture reveled. Being explanatory, narratives of a beginning are always constructed post factum and are inherently teleological. They are, in other words, both mythos and logos. At the beginning of the Iliad, in other words, for us, right at the very beginning, Homer asks the muse to sing of Achilles' wrath and its consequences. That is, this will be the subject of his song, but he tells us also that there was an end, a telos, and the plan of Zeus was being brought to its telos, was being fulfilled, reached its telos. The beginning is already at the end, is indeed determined by the end. But it is clear that Homer is also there concerned with a beginning. Which god led them to fight in strife with each other? It was the son of Leto and Zeus. Ancient scholars could not agree what Zeus's plan was, and modern scholars have merely complicated the matter. In fact, behind each beginning, and this is something that we'll see as a recurrent pattern, not just, I think, in ancient Greek literature, behind each beginning stands always other explanatory narratives with the power to seep out and complicate, if not in fact undermine, the subsequent narrative. Against this background, the apparently pressing need, expressed in some fairly strong language by some of my classical colleagues, of the need to choose just one reference for the will of Zeus at the opening of the Iliad, to the exclusion of any excess of meaning, casts interesting light on the nature of some forms of scholarly territorialism and scholarly insecurity. The father of modern narratology, Gérard Genet, wrote of the unavoidable difficulty of beginning. And where do I begin is not just a very difficult literary question, though it is that also. Making choices about where one begins always implies a choice about where one ends and where one goes. We find it increasingly difficult to separate history from historical narratives and/or stories, whether we look to why such narratives are told or to their effect in the world. Thucydides shows himself aware of the dangers that attend eyewitness reports, for example. You cannot believe all you hear from informants. Anyone who watches the news on TV, particularly from the world's really troubled places, will appreciate Thucydides' claim that eyewitnesses, quote, do not all give the same account of events, but what each says is determined by their partiality or their memory. Many of us, on reading Thucydides, may, for example, think of the modern Middle East, but unsettling examples lurk closer to home also. Where something began is not a neutral question. The world around us is full of painful illustrations, which again require no listing, of the truth which lurks behind the fact that ancient Greek uses the same word for responsible for as at fault for. Beginnings are used in antiquity as today to explain whole stretches of complex, tortuous history. And the celebration of beginnings in, for example, festivals, public holidays, and public cult reinforces the historical narratives which those stories enshrine. It was again Thucydides who famously thematized the issue of where something really begins. And it was Thucydides who nudges us towards the realization that cause and beginning are not always synonyms. This he does, of course, by his distinction between when and how the Peloponnesian War began, with, on the one hand, its causes, its aetii, and on the other hand, the truest reason, the truest prophecies, as he says, which, in his view, was growing Athenian power and the fear provoked by this growing power in Sparta. Another Thucydidean argument which strikes us as very modern and very terrifying indeed. This complex etiology for the war, which has been, I think, rightly called arguably Thucydides' greatest single contribution to history writing, was presumably written in response to Herodotus' equally famous opening claim that he will write for what reason the Greeks and the barbarians fought each other. Whatever one thinks of Herodotus' assessment of causes, he, perhaps more than anyone else, taught us always to take the long view in such matters. It's worth remembering that in matters such as the hostility between peoples, it is indeed the long view, usually enshrined in popular memory, which is paramount and which determines which stories and histories are told. The very scale of Herodotus' undertaking points us towards a very important truth. Now, there are more than one way that things might begin. They might begin with single one-time events, or perhaps I should say they might be alleged to begin with single one-time events. This was a kind of narrative with which the ancient Greeks were very fond and very familiar, and scholars normally refer to these as etiological narratives. Why is life hard? Because once upon a time, Prometheus stole fire, which the gods had hidden to try, but Prometheus stole it to try to help mankind. And in retaliation, Zeus and his fellow gods created an enticingly beautiful woman called Pandora, whom the foolish Epimetheus let into the house. And previously, says the poet, the tribes of men had lived upon the earth quite free of evils and without grievous toil and grim diseases. But the woman took off the great lid of the jar and scattered the contents and created dire woes for men. Hope alone remained in its unbreakable home, inside beneath the lip of the jar, and it did not fly out, for she closed the lid of the jar again through the plans of Zeus. So there is a one-time story, and the mode of that story is familiar. There are three, I think, important characteristics of such stories. One, they should be truly cosmic, that is, they often involve the gods. Secondly, the one-time event itself conforms to some extent already to the realities which it seeks to explain. In other words, once again, the end is already in the beginning. Pandora is clearly already an avatar of all contemporary women, in Hesiod's view, I should hasten to add. And the fact that it is a jar which she opens and from which she scatters the contents is clearly relevant to the agricultural world of Hesiod and his audience. Explanation and description seep into each other, and that is to remain a fundamental feature of such stories. And such stories, of course, continue with us and are constantly put before us as explanations of things in the modern world. One example upon which I wrote at length in the written version of this paper was the etiology, which one of the most famous classicists of the 20th century, E.R. Dodds, gives for the writing of one of the most influential classical books of the 20th century, The Greeks and the Irrational. Some years ago, says Dodds, I was in the British Museum looking at the Parthenon sculptures when a young man came up to me and said with a worried air, I know it's an awful thing to confess, but this Greek stuff doesn't move me one bit. I said that was very interesting. Could he define why? And he reflected, and then he said, well, it's also terribly rational, if you know what I mean, and I thought I did know. So there we have a one-time explanation for the writing of a great book. And Dodds goes on to say that it was that conversation which set him thinking about about this very issue of the Greeks and the rational and the irrational, and hence the book. But when Dodds came to write his autobiography, there is no mention of this conversation with this mysterious young man. What we have rather is an example of perhaps the most common alternative mode of explanation, which is not a one-time event, but it is a long process. And in his autobiography, Dodds explains how when he was lucky enough to be invited to be, say, the professor in Berkeley, he had the chance finally to write what he had been reflecting on for 30 or 40 years, namely, curiously enough, the Greeks and the irrational. So that there, the same event is explained in two quite different ways, as one-time event and as process. Now, naturally, we could, if we wanted to, seek to make those two stories, or are they histories, compatible with each other. But what would be the point of that? What we should rather be interested in is what each of those two stories has to tell us, why they are chosen. Now, as far as the first story is concerned, I think it's fairly clear why Dodds wanted to make the Parthenon sculptures, if you like, emblematic for his book. Because what he wants to do in that book is pick away at the what he sees as a bland and constructed facade of Greek rational culture to reveal a living, breathing organism where very dark forces were at work, or at least where there was a great deal which was not susceptible to explanation, or we might say to history. So to represent the alleged view of Greek culture which he wants to unpick, he could hardly have done better than to choose the Parthenon marbles, celebrated as untouchable masterpieces, the highest expression of Greek genius, set out on timeless, permanent display. Dodds, as young man, in fact, is at an unknown number of removes descended from Nietzsche, who, in The Birth of Tragedy, conjures up the Olympian gods of Apolline culture, quote, who stand on the gables and whose deeds adorn the friezes in brilliant reliefs visible from a great distance. For the young man's rational, we could easily substitute Apolline, as Nietzsche's use of that term has frequently been misunderstood, however influential that misunderstanding has been. So that it's also a story, of course, which tells us about the classical. I want to close, because I'm sure I'm out of time, I want to close by saying just one more thing about stories of beginning which are about the classical. Zeno from Citium, who founded the Stoic school of philosophy, consulted the Delphic oracle as to how he should live best. And one of the answers he received was that he should live best if he slept with the dead. Zeno, we are told, understood what the god was saying to him and immediately took up classics. Is reading classical literature like sleeping with the dead? Well, yes and no, we might say. What we have, of course, at one level is a humorously simplified version of a complex of ideas which had a profound effect in ancient rhetorical theory, and go back to Plato's metaphysics and his theory of inspiration. And when our chairman said in introducing the panel that one of the things we should do about the classics, and particularly about its stories, was to love them, what we have there was a faded echo of what was a real discourse in antiquity about the erotic power of the classical. Zeno did, in fact, sleep with the dead and was a highly productive in so doing. In other words, he founded, of course, a great school of philosophy. The story of how Zeno came to philosophy then is like the story of how Dodds came to write The Greeks and the Irrational, thoroughly emblematic. It is a story in which the end, or perhaps I should say the ends, are already written in the beginning, or should I again say, in the beginnings. And this is something that Professor Buxton will be talking about more in the paper which follows mine. It will, of course, be no news to anyone that accounts of how it all began are not innocent of what they seek to explain. But it may be that a focus on such narratives is one way of trying to find a proper use for the distinction between story and history, if there is, of course, a proper use. It may be, as we will have discovered by lunchtime, that story and history is not the right dichotomy. As the ancients knew only too well, there is in the end no getting away from the why question. Whatever the truth, there can be no doubt that Athens is the right place to begin the search. Thank you.